Welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Lauren Chapman with the latest on the EPA visit to East Chicago. Jill Sheridan reports on Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush participating in a national panel discussion on legal issues in the opioid epidemic. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with State Senator Eddie Melton about the 2018 General Assembly session. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The Environmental Protection Agency visited East Chicago Saturday to update residents on contamination cleanup. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports, EPA Region 5 Administrator Kathy Stepp and U.S. EPA Senior Advisor Albert Kelly attended the briefing and listened to public comment.
Residents heard updates from the on-site remediation coordinators and participated in sometimes heated Q&A sessions. Those comments were heard loud and clear, says U.S. EPA Senior Advisor Albert Kelly. A resident asked Kelly to attend. Kelly says this is his sixth trip to East Chicago, and the public needs opportunities to tell national officials their concerns.
The people that show up that represent the government, which is what we are, naturally are going to take some criticism because of the frustration that has existed for decades.
The public voiced frustration about arsenic and lead contamination, demolition of the former housing complex in Zone 1, and possible groundwater contamination from the property next door to the Superfund. The EPA will start wide-scale remediation of Zone 2 in May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The father of a four-year-old boy killed in a Gary apartment fire expressed concerns about his son's safety during a court hearing 6 days before the deadly blaze. The Times reports court transcripts show Christopher Harden told a magistrate he feared for his son Christopher Gober's safety during a March 19th child support hearing. Gober and his two-year-old sister, Kaylani Gober, died 6 days later in the March 25th fire. Harden says he's devastated. He says the child's mother prevented him from seeing his son in the months before his death. 33-year-old Kristen Gober faces two counts of child neglect causing the youngster's death. Authorities say she left them unattended with a 6-year-old brother, and the children started the fire while playing with the stove. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A second baby was discovered Sunday evening in a Safe Haven baby box in Cool Spring Township, just outside of Michigan City. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Bongiano has more.
This is the second baby found in the same box within 5 months. Republican State Representative Martin Carbaugh says the baby box is a proactive step in keeping babies safe. He says the box should be considered more of a last resort when surrendering a baby. But he says it's encouraging that the boxes are being used or at least considered because they serve another purpose.
And so they've really been more than just a place where a baby can be left. They've been a promotion of our safe haven law that's been on the books, but maybe not real well known to the public.
The baby box was installed at the Cool Spring Fire Station in April 2016. There are two boxes in the state, the other in Woodburn outside of Fort Wayne. Carbaugh says more hospitals and fire stations across the state are interested in installing baby boxes since a bill passed this session defining locations where boxes can be installed. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Bongiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Gasoline prices are starting to shoot up in Northwest Indiana. That's according to Gas Buddy Head of Petroleum Analysis, Patrick DeHaan. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
Gas prices across most of Northwest Indiana are going up to $2.89 a gallon, whereas outside Northwest Indiana, the rest of the state is looking at an increase to $2.79. Of course, this time of year, Northwest Indiana makes a switch to reformulated gasoline, whereas the rest of the state doesn't have to. So
DeHaan says that's why gas prices are a little higher, and this comes as oil prices have hit their highest level since 2014, and that's affecting gas prices. Northwest Indiana has to comply with having a cleaner blend of gas that the rest of the state isn't required to use.
It's an EPA requirement that areas of Northwest Indiana where there tends to be a lot of factories, a lot of emissions, they have to have cleaner gasoline coming out of the tailpipes of all those vehicles. So this is something that the EPA requires. It's called reformulated gasoline.
DeHaan said Wednesday afternoon that Gas Buddy was already seeing several Northwest Indiana gas stations go up to $2.89 per gallon.
So If you can find it for, say, under 260, maybe a good idea, because by tomorrow, you're going to see a lot of stations charging a much higher price.
Prices in neighboring states are also starting to jump as well, including Michigan, Kentucky, and Ohio. Motorists should expect prices to quickly rise to $2.99 per gallon in Chicago's suburbs, $2.85 per gallon at many stations across Michigan, $2.75 in Kentucky, $2.75 in areas of West Virginia, $2.69 at stations in Ohio, and $2.59 in areas of Wisconsin. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush participated in a national panel discussion on legal issues in the opioid epidemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the panel met in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday to focus on common challenges.
Chief Justice Loretta Rush co-chairs the National Judicial Opioid Task Force to examine the impacts of the opioid crisis on the justice system. At the Legal Services Corporation's annual forum, Rush spoke about the need to understand the epidemic from a health angle.
Some of the key goals we have for the National Judicial Task Force are to educate our judges, because one thing we know as judges is the science of addiction.
Rush says in over 20 years as a judge, she's never seen a crisis like this. Other panelists included judges from other states and legal experts. The discussion covered family law, child neglect cases, a lack of services, and other related issues. Participants also underlined the need to collaborate more. Issues often crisscross different areas of the law. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A former Northwest Indiana teacher faces nearly two dozen charges for his alleged sexual misconduct with boys during after-school baseball lessons. 46-year-old Joe Keimerer was fired in March as a fourth-grade teacher and baseball coach at Amelia Earhart Elementary School after the allegations surfaced. The Journal and Courier reports Keimerer initially faced 13 charges, including vicarious sexual gratification with a child, for his alleged actions with male students during after-school baseball pitching lessons at the Lafayette School. But he's now charged with a total of 21 counts after three additional boys told authorities that he'd victimized them. Keimerer also faces two counts of violating no-contact orders for allegedly leaving notes of apology for two of his alleged victims' fathers. A message seeking comment was left Tuesday with Keimerer's attorney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hoosiers have a few days left to file their taxes for 2017. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on what Indiana taxpayers need to know before Monday's deadline.
Hoosiers who file their state and federal taxes online can submit electronically anytime before April 18th. For those who use paper to file, State Department of Revenue Commissioner Adam Krupp says their returns must be in the mail by the 17th.
It can arrive after April 17th, but it needs to be postmarked that day.
Krupp says changes from the federal tax overhaul bill passed by Congress a few months ago apply to taxes people will file in 2019.
All of the things people have been hearing about in terms of doubling that standard deduction, lowering the rate of those seven tax brackets, those are for next year.
Krupp says most Hoosiers file their taxes online, which produces a lower error rate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's Black state legislators will hold a series of town halls around the state beginning this weekend. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on events meant to provide an opportunity for constituents to meet face-to-face with their lawmakers.
This is the third year for the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus's town halls. Caucus Chair Cherish Pryor says the events help lawmakers tell constituents about the results of the legislative session and give citizens an opportunity to connect with their government.
We invite the mayors to come. We also want to make sure that the legislators in that area attend as well.
All the current members of the caucus are Democrats, but Pryor says they emphasize they want all interested constituents to attend.
The focus is not on being Democrat or Republican, it's providing the information to people.
The first town hall is in Indianapolis, with future meetings in East Chicago, South Bend, Fort Wayne, Terre Haute, and Evansville. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Indiana Debate Commission is now accepting questions from Hoosier voters for its April 30th statewide televised debate in the Republican U.S. Senate primary race. In keeping with its mission of putting voters first, the commission invites Hoosier voters to submit their questions on its revamped website, www.indianadebatecommission.com. Questions are vetted by members of the commission. Those who submit may be invited to ask their questions of the candidates in person during the hour-long debate. The practice of using primarily voter questions is unique in Indiana. The commission, a nonprofit organization, is the only independent organization in the state that provides free broadcast satellite feeds and web streams to all news media, including college and high school press associations. The upcoming Republican primary debate will be the 19th debate hosted by the Indiana Debate Commission since its founding in 2007. Commission President Jerry Lenosa says, "We look forward to once again providing a truly statewide platform for candidates to present their views to Hoosier voters." He goes on to say, "At the same time, we are proud that our debates also present the voices of the public to the candidates." The April 30th debate will be broadcast at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at WFYI-TV in Indianapolis. Two candidates in the three-way race, U.S. Representative Luke Messer and business owner Mike Braun, have agreed to participate. The third candidate, U.S. Representative Todd Rokita, initially declined the invitation, which remains open. The debate will be moderated by Abdul Hakim Shabazz, an Indianapolis attorney, radio host for WIBC Radio, and owner of IndyPolitics.org. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
Some of Indiana's largest industries could stand to benefit if the United States moves forward with rejoining Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. As WFIU's Barbara Brozier reports, President Donald Trump is asking trade officials to look into the possibility.
The Indiana Farm Bureau is applauding President Trump's decision to reconsider joining the massive trade deal. Trump backed out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership as one of his first acts as president last year. Director of National Government Relations for the Indiana Farm Bureau, Robert White, says the partnership with 11 Pacific Rim countries would help alleviate some of the financial pain farmers are feeling as a result of back-and-forth tariffs with China.
The upside of TPP would be to gain additional markets for exports.
Andreas Hauskrecht is a clinical professor at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. He says the benefits for the U.S. go beyond economics.
TPP would address so many issues such as environmental, worker rights, public procurement, trade unions.
11 other countries ratified the TPP last month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A new national poll shows a potential spike in young people voting in this year's midterm elections. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith talks to an Indiana University political scientist about whether to expect more young Hoosiers heading to the polls in November.
37% of people under 30 say they will definitely vote in November's election. That's up from 23% who said the same in 2014, the last midterm cycle. The data comes from the Harvard Kennedy School's Institute for Politics, which IU political scientist Marjorie Hershey says has been good at predicting turnout.
Now, that being said, saying that you're going to vote 6 months from now is quite a bit different from actually going to the polls.
Hershey says getting young people to vote is usually the result of someone else's influence.
That somebody else might be a turnout campaign. It might be a friend or a neighbor.
Hershey says just getting young people registered is key, and 96% of those in the poll who say they're definitely going to vote are already registered. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
A shortage of brown trout in Illinois has spurred Indiana to turn to its northern neighbor to supply the popular game fish for an annual restocking effort. The Indiana Department of Natural Resources says its Michigan counterpart has agreed to provide 40,000 brown trout as 6-inch fingerlings in April. Indiana officials say that cooperative arrangements helped save the Hoosier State's annual brown trout restocking in and along the state's Lake Michigan shoreline. About 30,000 of the young brown trout will be restocked at the East Chicago Marina. The rest will be released into Trail Creek, a Lake Michigan tributary. Indiana has historically received brown trout from Illinois in return for providing that state with steelhead. But production shortages this year in Illinois required Indiana to reach out to Michigan. And Hoosiers without a fishing license won't need one to go fishing later this month at the state's public-owned lakes and rivers. The State Department of Natural Resources says Hoosiers can go fishing April 21st without a fishing license or a trout stamp. That Saturday will be the first of four free fishing days this year in Indiana. The other three are May 19th, June 2nd, and June 3rd. Those days give residents and their families a chance to fish because adults won't need a fishing license on those days. Children ages 17 and younger do not need a license on any day. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
The National Constitutional Coalition of Patriotic Americans will host a pro-Second Amendment rally in Indianapolis Saturday. WVPE's Barb Anguiano reports.
The event is expected to run about 2 hours and coincides with similar events across the country. Tomorrow's rally will take place at the Indianapolis State House, where attendees will gather to hear speeches from state representatives and Second Amendment advocates. One of those advocates is Jack Papillo of Valparaiso. Last month, he organized a rally in support of gun rights on the same day and same time as the March for Our Lives protest taking place nearby.
I think there are a lot of people that are willing to stand up for their individual rights and their right to own a gun, but are just, you know, they've got nowhere to go. I mean, I was surprised by how many people sprung up and immediately started helping me and, you know, join the cause.
Tomorrow's rally begins at 2 p.m. with a march around the Capitol complex afterwards. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
Whenever a gun control debate comes up, gun sales go up too. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting Charlotte Tuggle reports, Indiana firearms dealers say the sales jump after the recent March for Our Lives wasn't as significant as what happened under the last presidential administration.
It also has a bipod built into it if I'm shooting prone.
Inside a Lafayette shop called Applied Ballistics, owner Aaron Lorton is showing off a customized AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. It's got some extra gadgets, but it's functionally the same as the AR-15s for sale across the shop, and the one used to kill 17 students at Florida's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School earlier this year. Lorton says they're popular because they're customizable, adjustable, and more recently, in the news.
6 months ago, you couldn't sell an AR rifle. Like, nobody was interested because everybody that wanted one already had one, or two, or three. Now, when it's in the news, all of a sudden, people are interested again.
Lorton says the same happened when lawmakers proposed a ban on bump stocks, an attachment that allows a semi-automatic weapon to fire ammunition faster, and was used to help kill 58 people and injure hundreds more at a concert shooting in Las Vegas last fall. But Lorton says he hasn't seen as significant a jump in sales as when multiple bans were proposed by President Barack Obama.
Ironically enough, there would probably, in my opinion, be about half the number of ARs in circulation if nobody'd ever talked about banning them.
Drive about an hour north and you'll hear the same at another locally owned gun shop. You might even hear this on the way.
Armed robbery, church or school shootings, home invasions. Today's world is not the world your parents grew up in. It's an age of terror, and you shouldn't have to live in fear. That's why Liberty Arms in Monticello is ready to show you the best ways to protect your family, home, or place of business.
Next to Liberty Arms entrance is a sign saying unlawful activity will be met with lethal force. On the door, a note from owner Phil Hunt's wife politely asks customers to please check their shoes for mud before coming inside.
Obama was the best gun salesman out there.
Indiana's gun numbers back up Hunt's statement. During the last decade, there's been a steady increase in background checks. According to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, the two highest counts of checks correlate to the months of mass shootings in San Bernardino, California, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Shortly after the shootings, assault weapon bans were proposed on the federal level, but were never close to passing. Hunt admits in the wake of those tragedies, sales went up.
I do not enjoy selling guns under those conditions.
The numbers show when people are afraid firearms will be restricted or taken away, sales spike. So it follows that a Republican-controlled administration, perhaps especially one that has been criticized by gun control activists for the amount of money it receives from the National Rifle Association, might put Second Amendment advocates at ease. That could be one reason the number of background checks had begun to dip in the last 2 years, until February's Parkland, Florida school shooting. But Hunt says he's wary even a GOP Congress and White House might hurt his business.
They always act like they're the pro-gun people, but then they go ahead and they let them have the bump stock thing. Even Trump. That was a negotiated thing, I suppose.
Gun control activists are now pushing for a return of the national assault weapons ban that existed from 1994 to 2004, as well as halting the sale of high-capacity magazines and mandating background checks for all gun sales. Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence President Ed Smith says the latter provision would close a loophole used to get around background checks at federally licensed gun dealerships.
All they have to do is go to a private seller and they get the same thing, even after they've been denied by the federal firearms dealer. So, you know, it's a real problem. And so it is the laws.
And Smith says the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives should be given the authority to shut down gun shops linked to a high number of crime guns. The ATF gives store owners sole discretion on who to sell guns to, and Liberty Arms owner Phil Hunt says that's a serious responsibility.
That can be good or bad. That puts a lot of weight on our shoulders. Obviously, if two people walk in together, and the one person wants the gun, but the other one is filling out the paperwork for the gun, that's a no sale.
That's called a straw purchase, buying a gun for someone else. At Applied Ballistics, Aaron Lorton tells his staff that if they have a bad feeling about a sale, they shouldn't make it. He says not every shop may be as careful, though.
Any profession you pick, there are always going to be bad apples in it, right? So I can't say it doesn't happen. I can say that we do what we can to not let it happen here, because I have no interest in that, right? I don't need to sell a gun that bad. But it's always a concern.
Meanwhile, people are still buying guns. Both Lorton and Hunt say they're not going to benefit much from retail stores, including Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods, pushing up their minimum sale age to 21, because 18 to 20-year-olds make up such a small portion of buyers. And when the next mass shooting happens, FBI data suggest gun shops in Indiana and across the nation are likely to see business increase once more. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Today's high school students navigate stressors that range from test-taking anxiety to skyrocketing college costs, from the angst of social media to the fear of school shootings. Indiana schools are trying to mitigate the challenges to mental health, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg reports the problems may be even worse at schools that are highly rated and often high pressure.
Gia Bradford has some words of hard-earned advice she'd give her freshman year self, if she could.
And also take the SAT earlier.
True.
Because I did not take that earlier enough.
Bradford is a senior at West Lafayette High School. She and her fellow seniors are in the last months of their high school careers, so they're starting to relax a little. But the past 4 years haven't been worry-free. Sometimes, says senior Gabriella Espinoza, the pressures are self-imposed.
I came into high school and I wanted to be valedictorian.
Espinoza says she filled her time with advanced placement courses, but eventually realized trying to do too much was stressful. The students all agree theirs is a competitive high school. They wonder if they participate in too many extracurricular activities or too few. And they all know someone who struggled with depression.
The number one issue is anxiety. It has been the theme this year, and probably for the last school year as well.
Libby Sheffield is a West Lafayette High School counselor. Sheffield isn't just responsible for students' academic concerns. Her role includes helping manage their emotional and social health. But school counseling departments don't always have the capacity to reach every student.
There aren't enough of us counselors to go around to help all the kids who are in need.
According to the American School Counselors Association, the ideal student-to-counselor ratio is 250 to 1. Sheffield says West Lafayette High School meets this preferred ratio after bringing in an additional counselor last year. But prior to that, the ratio was approximately 400 to 1. And even that is better than some Indiana schools. Sheffield says teachers are often among the first to identify students in need of help. And often, she says, they're in the best position.
But the adult who has been with that student week after week, day after day, and knows that student, when that student walks in and something's not quite right, then the teacher typically picks up on that.
Indiana school years are typically 180 days long, but West Lafayette Superintendent Rocky Killian says school still accounts for a small minority of the total time in a student's life, too much of which he thinks is now taken up by testing.
And then having children spend nearly 2 weeks of their instructional year in standardized testing, it's inhumane.
And data suggest the pressure may be affecting students' mental health. Indiana ranks last in the nation in recent rankings from nonprofit group Mental Health America for the percentage of adolescents who've suffered a major depressive episode in the last year. And even in one of the state's most populous areas, Tippecanoe County families today face shortages of mental health resources, especially those geared specifically towards adolescents. At Lafayette's Willowstone Family Services, there's a waiting list for counseling. And Lisa Marie Lucy, Willowstone's Director of Clinical Services, says tackling mental health concerns early is key in preventing issues in college or adulthood.
When you start out with somebody who just has test-taking anxiety, if you don't deal with that, it can blossom into something different.
Lucy says pressures have only increased for today's teenagers.
And I've been finding more these days over the past probably 10 years. There's more pressure to be perfect, to perform better, to be the best.
Being the best means going to a good college if you're a senior at West Lafayette High School. Gia Bradford still didn't know where she was going with only a month before decision day.
It's just anxious waiting because a lot of people like already have their decisions, which I think is great, but then you're also kind of waiting and be like, people like underclassmen, people are like, oh, where are you going? And I'm just like, oh, you know, I don't know yet.
Amid the increasing noise in their lives, Indiana students must focus more than ever on tests, both of their academics and of their emotional well-being. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Carl Lissick, host of Greenfleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talking with Therese Holler, Executive Director of the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of the Greenfleet Radio. Today, our guest is Therese Holler. She's the Executive Director of the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Therese, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today, Carl.
You know, I just wanted to first start out by congratulating you on the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District winning the South Shore Clean Cities Excellence in Environmental Education Award at a recent annual meeting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure that I took the opportunity to say really fully how grateful we are to be honored and recognized by our peers in the environmental education and advocacy arena. We really appreciate that. We're all working really hard to get our messages out, but it's nice to know that our peers are recognizing us for that. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome and well-deserving, and I know you're doing some great things, but you know, a lot of our listeners are not familiar with the Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. We are actually a government agency, and our mission is to improve the environment and quality of life for our residents in Porter County and in the region by providing environmental education and programs that are voluntary. And it offers individuals the opportunity to first reduce the amount of waste they're creating through our education efforts. But then when they do have waste, we have alternative recycling and disposal options, keeping waste out of landfill and our environment.
Which is amazing. Because, again, since I've been involved with South Shore Clean Cities, it just seems like our recycling rates continue to improve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something with green buildings and, you know, everything that's going on within the industry. It's just wonderful to see this going on right here in Porter County. So, you know, congratulations on the great work that you do. So I know you've got a lot of exciting things that are taking place. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Northwest Indiana Earth Day and Reuse Fair?
Sure. Every year around Earth Day being April 22nd, we always try to hit a Saturday prior to that day to have a day where it's a family-oriented event where the families and participants can come in and hear from vendors, exhibitors that have products, services, or message about reducing our individual impact on the environment. So we're really excited. This is our 13th year for the event. It's free. It's from 9 to 2 at the Porter County Expo on Saturday, April 21st. And we encourage families to come out and participate in that. And we've incorporated an additional service at that day, we think will encourage more people to come out and participate. It's a reuse fair, and we have invited not-for-profits to tell us what types of products they would like from residents that are not new, but something that you or I might think about discarding, but these not-for-profits can use these products. For example, some really really quirky item that I just love to talk about is we have a zoo that actually is looking for perfumes. Because some of their animals react positively to having that perfume scent. So that's one of the items on the reuse fair. So people can find that information about what we're looking for. And it's dozens of items. So it's too much to talk about here. But they can go to our website.
And again, it's a great event. We've been attending. We've been participating with this event. And every year it gets bigger. It just seems like, you know, it's really something that a lot of our residents look forward to attending. And, you know, some of the youth that have come, you know, that are actually working at this. I know that for a fact. So it's been a great opportunity for our local area. And I know it includes all the counties. It's not just Porter County. You work with a multitude of the other county solid waste districts.
Yes, our neighboring districts from LaPorte and Lake County also participate in various ways at the event, supporting us there. And again, it's Northwest Indiana, as you pointed out. That's the name of the event, Northwest Indiana Earth Day Celebration.
So I also know that you have a household hazardous waste collection starting in May. And how do those work?
Well, basically, you're right. We start in May. Our first collection is Saturday, May 12th. All of our collections are on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. They're from 9 to 2. And basically, it's a drive-through program. So we're looking to aid residents in properly disposing of hazardous chemicals in the home that might be poisonous, toxic, corrosive. We certainly want to keep those out of landfills and our water system. So this is a drive-through program. You drive up, we remove the material from your vehicle, and you get to drive away.
Wonderful. And so I know you also have public compost sites as well. And I understand that Valparaiso compost, the compost site there in Valpo, has an open house coming up also.
We do. We're waiting to announce that date specifically. We're working on refining that. But we, the district, as an agency, all solid waste districts, we're officially a solid waste district. That's our government agency name. We have been around for well over 20 years, and we've been working in a great partnership with the city of Valparaiso at that compost site. However, I think still a lot of people don't know who we are. We try a lot of different channels to get our message out. So we came up with the idea to have an open house to try to get people that don't know about that site to come up there and see what happens there. It's a great program up there, a great partnership with the city. We are recycling your leaves and making compost for you to put back into your garden. So it is completing the full circle here in Valparaiso.
Wonderful. And then where can our listeners learn more about all of your services and events that are coming up?
Certainly, they can visit our website at www.portercountyrecycling.com. .org, and that's spelled out fully.
Okay. And any closing thoughts as we wrap up our program, Therese?
I just want to encourage people to check out our website and find out about all the services that are available to them through our agency, because they are funding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly like to take every opportunity to say to people, you're already paying for these services on your taxes. So please find out what you're paying for and use them. And collectively, we're going to be all in a better spot if you use these services.
And it's wonderful. Congratulations again on all the great services that you're providing and all the upcoming events. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Therese Haller. She's the Executive Director of Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District here in Valparaiso. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you, everybody.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. John Kane, host of Eye on the Arts, talks with Sam Love of the Zine and Small Press Fest.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Sam Love, president of the Calumet Artist Residency, which is located in Miller, right, Sam?
Yeah, that's correct. Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How long has Calumet Artist Residency been around?
Well, Calumet Artist Residency was formed in 2012 by Corey Hagelberg and Kate Land.
Mm-hmm.
I came in about a year later when they wanted to have community-based programming. Like a typical artist residency, we were bringing artists in from around the world to come to Gary and do work. We're at the connection of arts and nature. But we wanted to branch out more and do work in the community. And that was my background. I've got about 15 years of both education and social practice in Chicago. I was born in Merrillville, but I went to Chicago for a little while and decided to come back home in 2012. And then in 2016, we became a 501c3 nonprofit, which allowed us to start getting grant money. And we did the Gary Poetry Project last year, which I think you have a question about, and I'll say a little bit about.
Then I won't. Shall we talk about the Gary Poetry Project?
Sure. Let's
now?
Jump to that.
I think that sounds like a good time.
I had so much fun doing it. I want to keep talking about it forever.
Well,
so.
Go ahead. Feel free.
Well, thanks to the Knight Fund at the Legacy Foundation, as well as Art House, Indiana University Northwest, and Kids Stuff Play Systems, we had support to do a year long poetry writing project in Gary. We had money to hire young adults to lead poetry writing workshops. And what we would do is we'd collect a line from every participant and combine those together into one long big city poem, which we began to paint on buildings in Gary. We collected 1,100 lines in a city of about 77,000 people. We held 67 workshops and events last year. So, yes, more than one a week. And they were all wonderful. I can say that completely. Every one of them had just something different and special about it. So we're going to have some more public art coming up this year. You know, April is National Poetry Month. So we didn't want to just do this year-long poetry project and then never touch that again. We want to bring that as part of our repertoire. So late March, early April, we are going to wheat paste the entire poem, 1,100 lines, on the backside of our two-story building in Miller near Lake Street. So
that's
this
fantastic.
Is going to be about a 19-foot-tall poem.
You know, South Shore Arts, which I work for, we're going to be doing a big exhibit on public art and the documentation of public art projects like yours. And Ish Muhammad is going to be curating that show. So I think that your project is something that we're going to want him to include in the exhibit.
Oh, I would love to see Ish all the time.
He's
fantastic.
A great guy. So what is this zine thing you're doing? Tell me about that.
Oh, sure. So, for those who don't know, a zine is an informal publication, usually a very personal one. It dates back to I always say zine started in the 70s with punk rock and the availability of cheap Xerox. And so it was a way of making your own publication. Well, with the internet and blogs, they said it was going to disappear and print was going to die. But would you believe it? Zines are more popular now than ever. So the Lubeznik Center in Michigan City brought us on to do this small press fair and some workshops as well as panels. And that's going to be on the 21st of April in Michigan City. So you can either go to the Lubeznik Center website or calumetresidency.com. and find information about that. But it's going to be a full day. They'll have local publications for sale. There'll be a great crowd of people, art displays, and things for children as well.
So who's doing all these things? Do you have a paid staff?
A lot of it's volunteer from us, but our foundation money does allow us to tie it into these projects that we're doing.
So you hire instructors to help kind of moderate the whole thing. And are your organization's run by a small board, I take it?
As of today, we're going to be adding two new board members, which I'm really happy to say. So we have a board of seven and then a pool of volunteers who have kind of joined around us, and we're happy to have
them. Are you all artists of some sort, one way or another?
I would say so. Maybe some more than others. You know, Corey is a trained practicing artist. I feel like I fell into the arts when I was in Chicago. And I have things that I do, photography, writing, stuff like that. But we also have performers. We have very excited to introduce a young woman, Crystal Wilson, who is one of our main teaching poets. She's, I think, 22, 23 years old. So she's going to join us older groups in this. So we're an intergenerational group as well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of really interesting work.
Thank you.
And a very grassroots.
Very
grassroots level. Yeah, it's great. And we didn't talk about the Nature Project. And we don't have time either.
Okay.
So we'll have to have you back.
Some other time.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Well, Sam, that was great. Thank you for being here to tell us about your activities.
Thanks, John. Good to see you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with an extended conversation with State Senator Eddie Melton, representing Senate District 3, about the 2018 General Assembly session that just ended, a look at the upcoming short special session next month, and a peek at what Senator Melton may bring to the legislature in 2019.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of share my perspective with your listening audience on how I think this 2018 legislative session went. I definitely agree that with many of the folks that have watched this, this is probably one of the more interesting ones I've seen. Mm-hmm. Definitely by this being my second year as a legislator, some issues that we address from workforce development, identifying some issues that we continuously need to address from education and so forth, continuously are be at the forefront of the conversations legislatively. But all in all, I think that it was a good session. I think we ended very abruptly, not being able to address some issues, some which I think personally could wait to 2019, and some that can't. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested in seeing how we move forward with this very short session that the governor is calling us back for.
Okay. Some of the measures I know that you worked with your colleagues on in both the House and the Senate, actually, mm-hmm. Were very important. In particular, one of which we had a chance to highlight in a conversation with Senator Ed Charbonneau here not long ago, talking about dealing with the water infrastructure measure. And that was one of these successful ones that made it through.
Yes. Well, I just want to commend all of the hard work that Senator Ed Charbonneau has done when it comes down to addressing our critical water infrastructure issues. Here in alone, just Northwest Indiana, we have a very aged system. I believe a lot of the research and information that he's been able to bring forth to the our fellow senators and to the legislature has been helpful for us to understand the magnitude of this issue. And of course, we address infrastructure from a road standpoint last year. However, our water infrastructure is just as important mm-hmm. To our constituents and to residents and everyone in the state of Indiana. So I think what we've done in terms of creating what that financing structure looks like and how do we create a process where we can fund upgrading our water system is going to be extremely important moving forward.
Okay. You mentioned before here about some of the measures that you were especially pleased to be able to work on in the legislative session, dealt with education. We'll talk specifically here about mm-hmm. an update on the Gary Community Schools in a moment here, but fill us in on the bills that made it through that you were co-sponsor or sponsor of, dealt directly with education.
Well, many of your listening audience may be familiar with some of the lack of strategy when it comes down to workforce development. Mm-hmm. So we have Senate Bill 50, which in my opinion is kind of starting the process of how do we better communicate with all of our state institutions or state departments in coordinating efforts in workforce development, be it from high school all the way to some of our more non-traditional students. So Senate Bill 50 was something that I worked with Senator Doug Eckerty on. I believe we have a long way to go to create a more robust workforce development plan, but I think we got off to a good start. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 189 is something I worked with Senator Ryan Mishler on. He's the chairman of Appropriations, and there was a short funding gap this year in terms of funding public education. There were more students that enrolled that the state anticipated in public schools across the state of Indiana, and I believe we were short several millions of dollars to ensure that all of our public schools had the support and resources needed mm-hmm. To make that happen. Then there are other bills, and I don't have those exact bill numbers in front of me, that we address early childhood education, which is going to continuously be an ongoing subject matter and discussion. We're in dialogue and discussion about how do we address the teacher shortage, looking at it from a very different way and perspective at the quality of the test mm-hmm. To ensure that there's a very valid test that's not preventing quality educators from entering to this workforce.
Okay. I know that was one measure that you had worked with your colleagues on involving high school diplomas, among other issues.
Yes.
Tell us about that one and how things went with that.
Well, with the ESSA, which is this the federal regulations around Every Student Succeeds Act. That's mm-hmm. what it's called. There were some things that we as a state had to do to make sure we were in compliance with federal regulations. And part of that, there was a lot of controversy and conversations with the State Board of Education on some of the policies they had designed around the high school diploma. So I think we were able to address a lot of the issues that some of the higher ed institutions, as well as our local instructors, our local school leaders, superintendents and professions, to address making sure we have a clear, concise path when it comes down to high school graduation, what the diploma looks like.
Mm-hmm. You have also put out recently a guest commentary in the Times mm-hmm. Talking about how students should be ready for the future, and a lot of that has to do with getting the right education, and that comes in part as well, too, on some of the efforts that are being done at the State House on workforce development, that too, I understand.
Yeah, I think we have to approach this holistically. And we can't approach this in a fragmented way. Mm-hmm. From early childhood education to ensuring that all our schools have the resources needed, because education, the face of education, funding education has changed over the years. We have so many different methods, so many different types of schools. We have innovation networks. We have transformation zones. We have traditional public education, we have charter schools, and it continues to evolve. And I believe that we have to be very cautious as we think about what we want public education to provide our students and how we want it to look in the future and how we fund it and support it. But as we look at, as those students matriculate or transfer out of or graduate out of high school, you know, what are their next steps? What are their options? And we have to look at that as a region. We have to look at that as a state, as what are their options? How do we, you know, Lake County has a huge population loss that's occurred since the 70s.
Right.
You know, how do we address that in terms of making it attractive for students and young adults to stay in Northwest Indiana? And I say young adults, I'm talking about those that are at Ivy Tech, IUN, Purdue, Valpo, at our higher institutions in Northwest Indiana. How do we make it more attractive for them to stay, but also how do we make it more attractive and invite folks that do not live in our communities and make it inviting and welcoming for them as well to look at us as an option?
Okay. We're talking with State Senator Eddie Melton about some of the issues that have come up in the 2018 General Assembly session. It's finished. And one of the issues I know that had been reviewed, and you've signed on as a co-sponsor on a companion bill in the Senate, unfortunately didn't make it this time around. It's the measure that the city of Gary was most concerned about, dealing with the construction and demolition waste that will come about with more homes and structures being demolished. And I know that State Representative Earl Harris sponsored the bill, had a lot of support from other all of the members, I guess, pretty much of the Lake County delegation on this. And you went and carried it on into the Senate, but it suddenly died. And mm-hmm. if you will, fill us in on that. And do you think that maybe the measure, because I know there's a certain sense of urgency behind it, that we may come back up in 2019?
Well, just to kind of clarify a little bit about that, I did become a co-sponsor for mm-hmm. that bill. Myself and the other Northwest Indiana or Gary delegation differed in our thought about the legislation, and I shared that with them. I shared that with the mayor, and I just had a few concerns mm-hmm. that were expressed in the community. I think that we needed to vet it a little bit more closely before we moved forward in passing that legislation. So after talking with the chairman of the Environmental Committee in the Senate, that was Senator Doug Eckerty, he agreed not to hear the bill. And I agree with you. Let me kind of back up and make this statement and let folks know. I, without a shadow of a doubt, know that as a resident of Gary and as someone that was born and raised in Gary, know we have a blight issue. But how we go about addressing that blight issue, I think we have to be a little bit more inclusive and including the community on how we do that. Mm-hmm. When we look at the construction and demolition site that was being proposed, the specific legislation raised some questions in terms of the proximity to residential facilities. So I think working with the mayor, working with the legislators, my colleagues in the House, hopefully we'll be able to come to some type of understanding on how to best address the blight issue and utilizing our federal resources more efficiently and effectively.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there's a possibility that maybe this measure could come up in 2019 if it's been revised and maybe is properly tailored for the community?
Well, I've learned that you can never say.
You just never know.
You never know dealing with the legislature, but yeah. I'm optimistic that we're all willing to work together to fix this issue.
Okay. One of the other issues, and we know that you're the principal sponsor on it, actually got to see it become enacted into law, is dealing with the state takeover of the Gary Community School Corporation and the problems financially and academically that the school district has. And I know that you've had some concerns here, although I'm sure you feel that that Dr. Peggy Hinckley, who's the emergency manager, is doing, and her team members, I should say, are doing a good job in dealing with the problems with the Gary schools. But you have some concerns, and I know that you've voiced them about what's come out here. In particular, I know about whether, I guess, the emergency manager has the authority to take a step forward, maybe, and names of members of the school board and like. Tell us about that, and yeah. Do you think this is going to have any kind of impact in what could become future legislation?
Yeah, I definitely agree that we have to be very cautious on how we empower state entities or state-appointed entities mm-hmm. in dealing with local governing bodies. For example, you mentioned earlier about last year's legislation, Senate Bill 567, which was a state takeover of the school corporation. Well, that was something that we had to do to ensure that the district stayed intact and functioning from a fiscal standpoint with over $100 million of debt, and it was still compounding at that particular point. So I definitely want to commend Dr. Hinckley and her team on the hard work and the very tough and difficult decisions they have to make day in and day out when it comes down to the financial management, when it comes down to the academic sustainability of the district as well. The House Bill 1315 was giving the emergency manager the authority to select the board members if they were vacant. Currently, our Gary School Board is an elected body. The current statute, which allows the current governing body, if there is a vacancy, and there is a vacancy right now, that governing body should have an opportunity to select someone in the community to represent that seat, to replace that seat, and to select them as their, they should be able to select their leadership, be it the president, vice president, et cetera. Now, this board has absolutely no fiscal authority. They have no governing authority. So at this point, I think one of the things I wanted to communicate to the legislature was that we have to respect the institution of the electoral process. And although this body does not have the authority to make decisions, they were elected to represent a constituency. And I believe that we should continue to respect that process as we go through these changes in the district. Mm-hmm.
Finishing up this legislative session, we happen to see the leaving of office of some very key people in Northwest Indiana who've served the legislature well over the mm-hmm. decades. People like State Representative Charlie Brown, State Representative Scott Pilath in particular,
Linda
his leadership
Lawson.
Roles, and Linda Lawson, of course, yeah. from Hammond. What are your thoughts on losing this great drain of institutional wealth that is leaving the legislature?
Right. Well, first off, let me just say each individual that you just mentioned have contributed so much to not just the state of Indiana, but also Northwest Indiana. So I want to thank them publicly for their service in the legislature. I see this as an opportunity. I see this as an opportunity not just locally, but how do we address some of the new issues that are arising to the legislature. And bringing in folks that are willing to tackle those issues, being inclusive in a local level and working with the community and stakeholders to get more engaged on a policy-making process that impacts the lives of all residents in Lake County, Northwest Indiana, and throughout the state. So although it is a loss, I do see it as an opportunity for us to find leaders that can try their best to represent the constituents, to have an opportunity to elect them.
And finally, Senator Melton, looking ahead into 2019, we've talked about a number of bills and things that may possibly come back up in future legislation. Have you thought about anything in particular that you might bring up in the next session?
Yeah, I'll be focusing on the Department of Child Services. Of course, there are some issues that have come up and allegations that have come up in terms of the State Department of Child Services and their ability not to provide adequate services. I believe the governor and myself and others are very passionate about this, and I've talked to him and his team about it. He has a private entity that's doing a deeper dive into the issues, the Department of Child Services. But I was able to get a resolution passed through the legislature that I'm asking for us to form a special committee of both the House and the Senate, our Children and Family Services Committee, to be ready over the next 2 years to address the issues that come out of this report and study that the governor's having being done. I think that legislators should be well-versed and informed about what's taking place. We are talking about the lives of children, and every day we as a state, we are able to impact the lives of children that are not in the best of conditions. They are not in the homes of a loving family oftentimes, and they're there for a reason. So I think it is incumbent upon us to do everything that we can to make sure that the caseworkers, the supervisors, the providers to that agency have every single resource, every single tool available to them to address those needs of the children that we're talking about here. I think that's going to take some legislative action. I think it's going to take also a long-term approach on how do we ensure that we never arrive to a situation that we're in now wondering if we are doing the best job for children, but ensuring that we do the best job for these children.
Now, are we likely to see some requests coming forth here during this very special session coming up here about this?
Well, it was my hope that we could see that since we will have time to address this in a special session, that since this is such an imperative issue, that it should be addressed. I'm not sure when the final report will be provided to the governor and his department and his team. However, we do know that there are certain things that we can do now. They're low-hanging fruit. The turnover of case managers, the training of case managers, and ensuring that they can stick around and provide the care and attention that it takes, not just for one child, but multiple children at the same time, I think is going to be very key and important that we show them that we respect their job and we want to support them every way we can.
Senator Eddie Melton, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.